This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Thanks for being late. I know I get upset when you're late, and the shape of the shear has changed somewhat over the last hour, so at least you get the benefits of my being late. I haven't watched much of the rugby, but certainly not today. But something intrigues me, and that is it possible that the fact that the South African team is doing so well has something to do with the encouragement it's getting from the audience? And oh, we've got the answer already.
And if that's the
all those things, Mandela's Bishabera and all those things. And if that's the case, then is it just some kind of emotional hype that comes from having people around you that encourage you? Or is there actually a spiritual energy that can be transferred from the audience to the players? Because if there is such a spiritual energy, then that's an important energy to know about, because we can then use it in all sorts of different areas. And that's what I want to talk to you about today. And what I was doing now preparing was not watching replays of the game. There's a very frightening Gemara on Daf Ches and Tainis. Come and see how great are Baalei Amona. What is Baalei Amona? Probably the best way to translate it would be forces in which one trusts. Minayin? Michulda uvor. From the case of Chulda uvor, the cat and the pit. The cat it's called, talking about is not our kind of domestic cats, but the wild cats out in the fields that can be very destructive. What's the story of the cat and the pit? Explains Tosfos. Ma'aseh hayo b'nara achas. There was a young girl. Ha'isoreitzo leilech leveis havio, and she wanted to go home. And there was a pit on the way, and she fell into the hole on her way home. Uvo bochur echod, and a young man walked by, v'omar, and he heard cries coming out from the pit, so he looked inside the pit, and there he saw a beautiful girl. So he said to her, imani alech tinasili, if I get you out of here, will you marry me? That's the way to propose. Omra lo hein. She says, sure, yes, I would. V'nishbu'u b'nehem shehu lo yiso isho acheres v'hi lo tinosi lo ishacher. And they made a deal, they made a pact that he won't marry anybody else and she won't marry anybody else. They'll wait for each other. V'omru, and they said, mi me'id b'neinu? Who will give evidence? Where the aidim? Where are the witnesses for this deal? V'hoiso chuldo achas oileches lifnei haboi. There was a cat walking past the pit at that very moment. The cat and the pit will be our witnesses. Whenever we see a cat or we see a hole in the ground, we'll remember the story, and they'll be our witnesses. They'll remind us. And they each went their own way. That was the end of the interaction. She went home and he went home with this understanding between them. V'hi omdo bishvuoso. And she stuck to the deal. And she waited for him. And she looked forward to it. And the usual story. Meanwhile, fickle as the males are, he found somebody else who wasn't in a pit and wasn't in any particular trouble, but was at least equally beautiful. And he married her. Forgot about the girl in the pit. The Yoldo Ben. And they had a child together. Bos Chuldo Unashocho Vemes. And a wild cat came and bit that child, and the child died. Yolda Loy Ben Sheni, and they had a second child together. The Nofal Aboy Rumes, and the child fell into a pit and he died. Omra Loy Ishtoi Maze Amaise Shigi Alano, Shaloki Shab Neodam. This is very unusual. Our children are dying from very weird means. There's something wrong here. What's it all about? Nizkar Hashvua, all of a sudden he remembered the oath. The Sipe Loy Ishtoi, and he told his wife, Kol Amaise, the whole story. Omra Loy, she said, Imkein Chazor Vekacheno. Then you owe it to her. We have no right to be married. Wonderful woman she must have been. V'chosov lo get, and he wrote her a get. They divorced. V'holach v'noso es habesulo, and he went and married the young girl that he'd originally promised to marry. That was the story. V'haynu de'amri ha'maymin b'voir v'chuldo she'emidu eduson. That's what they talk about. The saying, as a result of that story, is one who believes in the pit and the cat. This is the Gemara. The Gemara goes on to say, Uma hamamin bechuldo uvoir kach hamamin b'kodesh baruch hu alachas kama v'kama. If believing in a pit and a cat can have that kind of impact, what about believing in the Rabbeinu Shlomo? Says Rashi, what does that mean? Shemesima eid beino levein chaveru alachas kama v'kama. If one makes Hashem the witness in a deal, how much more so that Hashem will make sure that the deal is adhered to? That's how Rashi learns it, but one can learn it also the more simple way, which I'm going to come to in a moment. And that is that, what does it really mean? Was it a coincidence that the two children got, the one got bit by the cat and bitten by the cat and the other fell into the pit? Was that a coincidence? Clearly not. Was it Hashem? Well, clearly it was Hashem. But that, the Gemara doesn't say that. The Gemara says, "Bore kama gedolim bale emuno." Come and have a look and see how great are things in which one trusts. Minayin, where do you see it from? From the story of the chuldo and the bor. That means, had they not trusted in the chuldo and the bor to be the witnesses, then the chuldo and the bor would not have been adequate witnesses. It was the trust they placed in these inanimate objects that gave those inanimate objects the power to do what they did. And that's the interesting relationship that we have to analyze in this Gemara. And that's how Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz learns this Gemara. That this is not just Hashem doing some kind of tit for tat or whatever it is. That the pit and the cat were actually invested with power through the position of trust in which they were placed. That gave them the power. And then the Kal Vachomer, if investing trust in an inanimate object like a pit or in an animal like a cat can give such power, how much more so for the Ribbono Shel Olam, which then means that we have the capacity to empower God. That's what it comes out, that we have the capacity through the trust we put in the Ribbono Shel Olam, we have the capacity to empower Hashem. And that in fact is emphasized by the same Gemara, where the Gemara says, Ein hagashomim yodim Elo bishvil ba'alei emuna. The same term. Rain only comes because of the people who trust. What does ba'alei emuna mean? What are the people who trust? So the Gemara in Shabbos says on Daf Lamed Aleph, Omer Eish Lokish Maidichti Vahoyo Emuna Sitech Achoysun Yeshua's Chochmas Vadas. What does it mean? And it will be that your belief in seasons will be a source of salvation, of knowledge, and of wisdom. Emunas ze seder zroim. Having emuna, having trust, that's referring to seder zroim, to the laws of agriculture. Explains Tosfos, Meforish b'Yerushalmi, that the Yerushalmi expands on this and says, what's so important about that? If a person's learning zroim, if he's learning the laws of agriculture, he's probably involved in agriculture, but he's involved in agriculture with a spiritual perspective. And that means, Shemamin b'chei ha'ulomim v'zoreya. When somebody plants, he's showing a belief in God. You take your money and you invest it in seeds, and you take your seeds and you plant them in the ground. Who says it's going to rain? So you believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam that there'll be rain. So it's a great act of trust of the Ribbono Shel Olam when you plant. And that applies not just to planting in an agricultural sense, that applies with any investment. If a person invests expecting future returns, it means he believes in a future. If he believes in the future, he believes in the Ribbono Shel Olam. Otherwise, what is the future? What is the meaning of the future? He believes there will be some kind of return. And that investment in the future is an act of belief which causes the rain to come, says the Gemara. So it's not we trust because it rains. It rains because we trust. Just as by trusting in the pit and in the cat, the pit and the cat were empowered to act in a way that was so powerful, so if we would trust, when we trust the Ribbono Shel Olam with our future, we give him the power to take care of our future. He so to say requires us to empower him. He requires us to give him the forcefulness with which he can deal with our future. Normally when we talk about empowerment in this country, we're talking about the top empowering the bottom. Here we're looking at something reversed. We're saying that even the Ribbono Shel Olam, so to say, has structured himself in such a way where he requires the power that we give him by trusting in him. And when we give him that power, then he does all sorts of wonderful things for us. And that's the Kal Vachomer that the Gemara says in Tainis. Bora'e kama gedolim ba'alei emunah. Come and see how great can be those in whom trust is placed. Minayin, from where? Michuldo avor. From the case of the chuldo and vor. If you place trust in a chuldo, in a cat, and in a pit, they're able to have the power to act on your behalf. Ma min bechuldo avor. If this is what happens when you believe in an old cat or a pit, can you imagine what power you give to the Ribbono Shel Olam to act on your behalf if you empower him, if you trust him, if you give him that trust? And with that we can understand the very pathetic phrase that Moshe utters in today's Sedra. And they start complaining about their own food. And they get food and they're still complaining. And Moshe said to God, why have you made life so tough for me? And why did I not find favor in your eyes where I pleaded with you not to give me this job? I was an old man of 80. I didn't need this job. Why did you force it on me? Losum es masor kol ha'om hazeh oloi, to give me the weight of this people to carry. Ha'onuchi horisi es kol ha'om hazeh, did I give birth to them? Am I their parent? Imanuchi eleditiu, did I conceive them? Did I give birth to them? Ki soimar elai so'eyu b'chekecha ka'ashe yiso ha'oimen es hayonek ala adamash nishbatu la'aviso, that you have charged me with the responsibility of carrying them like a mother carries her child in her bosom. Me'ayin li bosolo, says l'chom ha'amaza. Where have I got meat? They want meat now. Where have I got meat from? Ki yivko alai le'mo, they cry to me saying, t'no lo nevoso v'nochelo, give us meat so that we may eat. Lo'y uchol anochi levadi lo, says l'chom ha'amaza. I can no longer bear it. I can't carry this nation. I can't be responsible for them anymore. Ki choved mimeni, it's too much for me. Really pathetic. There's the great Moshe Rabbeinu, the invincible Moshe Rabbeinu, the Moshe that could do anything, who could challenge Paro and the whole Egyptian army, and he could challenge God and the angels and all the rest of it, showing his human frailty and saying, this is just getting too much, I can't anymore. And if you insist, horgeni no horoig, do me a favor, kill me, I would rather die. I don't want to go on with the suffering. So Moshe, we see from here the anguish, the suffering that Moshe endures. What happened to cause the suffering? What's gone wrong? He hasn't spoken this way before. He's acted very efficiently all the way through. Why all of a sudden he's been enthusiastic? Why this depression? Says the Sipurnu. Hinei ha'av yuchol lahanhiges bonov. What gives the father the strength to lead his family, to lead his children? Even though they're all different, he can have a large family, he can have 10 children, they're all different, they all have different needs, they all have different ambitions, they all have different requirements, different talents, and he can manage them. The reason is because all the children regard him as one who loves them. Sheyishtadel b'chol koicho lehitiv lohem. They know he'll do his best for them. Aval eile einam boischim boitchim biklal. But these people no longer trust me. V'choshtim u'menasim liris ma'ese b'odom. They're suspicious of me, and they're testing me. When they come and they say they want meat, it's not just because they're hungry. They want to see if I can magic it up for them. They want to see what kind of abilities I have. They're testing me. I'm too old for this, as Moshe. I don't need to be tested. I don't want to be tested. Once they're testing me, I've lost their trust. If I've lost their trust, I no longer have the energy. I no longer have the vibrancy, the dynamicism with which to lead them. A father can lead his children only because the children know that the father loves them. And that isn't an issue. There's total trust. And that trust enables the father to act. The mother gets up in the middle of the night and goes to the crying baby because she knows the crying baby trusts her. If the crying baby doesn't trust her, she doesn't feel like it. When she begins to suspect that the baby's trying to manipulate her, then she's a little bit careful. She doesn't get up so quickly. When she begins to suspect that the baby's trying to test who's boss, which babies tend to do quite early in their lives, and that when the mother's bright enough, most mothers aren't bright enough to realize that, but when the mother is bright enough to realize that and to know when it's that, when it's a baby crying in need, and when it's a brave baby who's lost confidence and is testing to see whether the mother's a shlumil, that every time I cry she comes running, or whether she's taka, a mother that I can be proud of, who can tell the difference, who knows when to come, when I'm manipulating, and she's taka the balabos. When the mother realizes that that's what the child is doing, then she doesn't. If she's a clever mother, she doesn't go running anymore. You want to test me out? I'll show you exactly. I know exactly when you need something and when you don't need something. And right now, you're not hungry, you're not thirsty, you're not cold, and you're not wet. So you just keep quiet. And the child responds to that. It's the same when the child gets a little bit older, when the child starts rebelling about bedtime and so on. Sometimes the child needs to find out whether the parent is there or not, whether the parent is an authority or not. And it goes through the teenage years, so it goes all the time. Very often the child is expressing a genuine need, and every now and again the child is testing the limits. What are the limits here? Do I have a parent, and what are the limits of this parent's authority? And Moshe says, I don't need to be tested. I'm over all that. I'm not their father. I'm not their mother. I didn't want the job in the first place. I don't have to go through this. I don't have to be tested by them. They're testing me now. They're not asking for food because they're hungry. They've just got them on. So I know they're not hungry. So why do they want meat all of a sudden? Just to test me, to push me to the limits. I don't want it. And having experienced for the first time the input of politics, they're showing this is political. This isn't a human relationship. This isn't a sense of need. This isn't a sense of trust. They're not turning to me and saying, Moshe, we trust you. We know you can take care of us. You always have and you always will. And we need meat now. We're terribly hungry. We need meat. Then says Moshe, I could have done it. But I can't do it if it's political. Then I can't do it. And I would rather die than have this. I don't want any of it. What do we see there? That same idea that one can do anything if one is trusted to do it. One can do nothing if one isn't trusted to do it. And one sees it over and over again in business, one sees it in families, one sees it in all sorts of, in education, one sees it in all sorts of relationships. So show the person, obviously assuming that the person has the general ability, but most people have ability far beyond what they're doing. Now show the person the trust. Show the person that he has the ability, that you trust him to do it, and that you need him to do it. And you'll be amazed at what people can do. Absolutely amazed at what people can do, including Moshe himself. Show the person that you don't trust him. Show the person that you're suspicious of him. And then it's not going to function at all. He's not going to be able to do it. There's a company that I consulted that has an American holding company. And the Americans came out, it's a completely non-Jewish company, the American company is non-Jewish and the local one. And the Americans came out with a whole new theory. And their theory was stop supervising people. And they've implemented it in America successfully, and they want the South African company to start implementing it. To stop supervising people. Employ people who are good enough and then leave them alone to get on with the job. Because they said, if you supervise a person, you are ensuring his non-performance. You're saying to him, I don't believe you'll do it. That's what you're saying. And if you tell him you don't believe he'll do it, he won't do it. So I turned around to the American companies and I said, that's all in the Torah already, we've learned that already. You guys have just discovered that that's old stuff. Chazal have been saying that for a long time. We've learned that and we've already implemented that. There's no question about it, that whether it's on the level of a Moshe Rabbeinu or it's on the level of a lowly worker. If you believe that he can do it and you show him that you believe that he can do it and you need him to do it, he will do it. Let's look at it a little further. What is it that gives him that need? The Gemara says in Chulin on Pei Dalad, "Lo'olam yechel adam v'yishter pachos mimashi yeshlo." When it comes to food and drink, spend less than you can afford. If you can afford a certain amount on food and drink, spend a little bit less than that. "V'yilbash v'yiskase b'mashi yeshlo." When it comes to clothing, as much as you can afford. "V'yechabed ishto yovonov." But when it comes to spending money on your wife and on your children, "yesu mimashi yeshlo." Spend more than you can afford. That's the Gemara says. It's interesting that people are becoming very frum and they're becoming very particular about all sorts of things, but there's some things they don't keep. This is one of the Gemara's people generally don't keep. They do it the other way around. When it comes to your wife and children, give them less than you can afford. When it comes to food, to clothing, maybe what you can afford, and when it comes to eating, much more than you can afford. And that's not what the Gemara says. Why that order? Why when it comes to eating, less than you can afford? And when it comes to clothing, as much as you can afford, and when it comes to your wife and children, more than you can afford. What does it mean, more than you can afford? How can the Gemara advise people to spend more than they've got? If we understand it, then we'll see. Eating and drinking, that's for yourself. That's purely self-interest. So there you, the least, spend as little as you can. Clothing is already more than that. Clothing is your interface with the outside world. So you've got to look like a mensch, you've got to be able to interact properly with people. It's important not only for yourself, but it's important for your interaction with others. So there's already an interest beyond yourself. When it comes to clothing, the interest goes beyond yourself. So included in clothing would all be all the image issues. Your clothing and your house and your motor car and the things that interface between you and other people, as much as you can afford. More than the food. But when it comes to the echabed ishto yevonot, more than you, give them more than you can afford. Why? I hardly know a family that can afford to have children. I hardly know a young couple that can afford, not hardly, I don't know a young couple who get married and can afford to have children. They can't. Certainly you do the sums, you look at their earning capacity, and you find they can't afford to have children. They're earning a certain amount and they're spending every penny of it and more just on the two of them. But they have children. And they have one child, and I don't know a couple who has one child who can afford to have a second child. They have a second child as well. And I don't know a couple who's got two children who can afford to have a third one. They have a third one as well. I don't know anybody who's gone bankrupt because he's got children. I've never heard of that. People have gone bankrupt because they've made bad business decisions. People have gone bankrupt because they've had bad luck in their business. All sorts of things, but I've never heard of anybody going bankrupt because they've got a large family. Never heard of that. I've heard of people saying, when the children are married and settled, I'll be able to afford all sorts of interesting, nice things. I've never seen that happen. Doesn't happen. Children get married and settled, and they carry on living the same lifestyle and sometimes a lower lifestyle. What does it all mean? We think you spend what you can afford. Chazal is telling us that you can afford what you need to spend. If you're spending on other people, if you're taking on responsibilities, the Rebbeinu Shlomo assists you to do that. If it's correct responsibilities, if it's responsibilities that you need to be taking on. And therefore, from a religious perspective, the economists won't agree with this at all, but that's tough luck. The fact is they're wrong and I'm right in this particular instance. The taking on of family responsibilities increases earning capacity, it doesn't decrease earning capacity. And there's no economic explanation for it. Does that? Why there's the Sipurna? That there is. The Sipurna says, here are a bunch of children who look to their father and know he'll do his best for them. And he does. They're trusting him, they need him. And the more a person is needed and trusted, the more he performs, the more he delivers. And the more he loves and cares for the people who trust him and who need him, the more he performs and the more he delivers. Let's look at it further. There's a medrash that I have quoted before, weird midrash. But now we can begin to understand it. Ma'aseh Abi Yossi Ish Tzitzer. This is a midrash in Parshas Kedoshim in Chof Dalet in the Midrash Rabbah. There was a ma'aseh with Abi Yossi in Tzitzer. Shaya Yoshev v'shomer al petach Maya. He was sitting at a spring and he was learning. Iskili Eloi Hohi Rucha. The Havishari Toman, and a spirit appeared to him. A ghost. Amalei said to him, Aton Yadin Kamashnin Anashari Hocho, Vaatin Venafkin Aton, Unashechin, Beramsho, Vetiharo, Veles Asun Misnazkin. Do you know how long I've been here? Says the ghost to Abba Yossi. I've been here for centuries. I've been here a long time. You've never even noticed me. You come often and you sit here and you learn. Your wives come here, they use the place as a mikveh. Men come here in the morning, the evening. They come and they go. Nobody's ever been damaged. But now you need to know the whole ruach bishboi mishrohocho. There's a bad ghost, a bad spirit that wants to come here. I've been a good guy, but this isn't going to go on forever. There's now a bad one who's coming here. And this is one that damages people. He likes to destroy people. So Abba Yossi said, so what should we do about it? This isn't bad news you're telling me. How are we going to prevent this? Omale, so the spirit said to him, Azil v'ashid bivnei mato, go and get everybody from the town. V'amolohim man d'isle makush, man d'isle pas, man d'isle magroifi, yifkun hocha. Anybody who's got tribal weapons, traditional weapons, come here. Come with their nobkiris and their sticks and their spears and their assegais. Tell them all to come. L'machor, in Metzamche de Yom, tomorrow morning, early in the morning, Yehoin Mistaklin al Api Maya, watch the water. V'chad inun chamyon irbuvya de Maya Yehoin makshin befarizlo. And when you see the water starting to move, then you'll know that we're starting to fight. The two spirits, me and the other spirits, are starting our battle. V'amrin, and you need to shout, Didon notzoch, ours is winning. Like the rugby. The rabbi is good spirits and bad spirits. That's all it is. The lo yifkud min hocho adzman di yachmun chardo de doma alapi maya. And they mustn't stop. They must keep on going and saying and shouting that until they see drops of blood on the water. Ozul v'asid bivnei kartav omalun man davele makush man davele pas man davele megroifi nafkun lamocho l'taman. He told them, he went to the town and he got everybody together and he brought them to the well. Now, I would have found this medrash difficult to believe if it weren't for the rugby. To get so many people to go schlepping to some place to watch two spirits have a fight, when there's nothing really in it for you, it doesn't really make much of a difference on the surface. Who wins? But people like a struggle like that, and they go. And he told them what to do, and they banged on their sticks, and they were omru didon nitzach, didon notzach, and they shouted, "Ours is winning! Ours is winning!" V'loy olum min tamon adzman dechamun chiminchal de dama alapi maya. And they didn't leave there until they saw little drops of blood on the water, and then they knew that theirs had won. V'harei dvorim kal v'chomer, and the Medrash says, you can make a kal v'chomer from this. Uma im haruchos sheloi nivru l'shum siyua tzrichim siyua. If spirits that don't need any support and help, that aren't created for support and help, need support and help. Anu shenivreinu l'siyua, we who are created for help, that's why we're created, to help one another. Alachas kameh v'kameh. How much more so do we need supportiveness and help? So once again we see this principle. Now here we see that it's not just an emotional thing, because these are spirits. Here it's not psychology. So up till now you might say, yeah, it's psychology. Show a person that he needs you and he'll respond. It's all matters of psychology. That's what I want to examine with you. Is this psychology or is this mysticism? Is this spirituality or is this psychology? So if all the stories of this kind of thing involve human beings, then I might say it's psychology, it's good psychology. Tell the person you need him, you value him, and that you trust him and you believe in him, and he'll perform nicely. That's the way the psychology of people work. But here we see it works with spirits. They don't have a psychology. They don't work with emotions. They work only with spirituality. And we see that the supportiveness that an audience was able to give those battling spirits enabled the one spirit to win. Not the fact that he was the better spirit. The spirit didn't say, look, I know I'm good. I know I've done the right thing all these years. God will make me win. Didn't say that. He said, this is going to be a tough battle and I don't know who will win. I need your support. I need you to help me. And this is what you need to do. Come and make a big noise and bang your sticks up and down and say, ours is winning, ours is winning. That will do it. It's exactly the same as a rugby match.
Which is quite frightening, because that means that there's a spiritual power that an audience is able to give.
That means it's not just a psychology, and that enthusiasm and that entrusting means, and by an audience I don't necessarily mean tens of thousands of people sitting in a rugby stadium. An audience can be in a family environment, an audience can be in a learning environment, an audience can be in a business environment, any two people. You can have one who's a performer and an audience. And if you start looking at life in that kind of sense, that in any interaction you've got a performer and an audience, and sometimes they switch roles. When the performer is finished performing and the audience starts clapping, then the audience becomes the performer. And when the performer bows, he's applauding the audience, who's applauding him. So the roles are changing all the time. Doesn't matter. When by a performer, we don't necessarily mean the formal performer. One is acting and one is being acted on. The one who's being acted on is the audience. And the role of audience and performer can constantly switch. But what we see is that the audience has the capacity to transfer. We had a show recently about energizing. This is the second in that series of energizing. The capacity of the audience to energize the performer. You remember we had it in the case of Reuven, who says, had I known that this would have been written in the Torah, I would have carried Yosef all the way back to his father. And I asked, what does it mean? Because people were watching, he would have done something better. Is that his morality? That depending on how many people are watching him, that's how he'll determine how good he'll be. And I explained, that's not so. What Reuven was saying is, I didn't have the koach, I didn't have the energy to resist my brothers, to fight them to the point where I could take Yosef, and I didn't have the physical energy to put him on my shoulders and run with it, go and get rid of all the opposition and take him back to his father. I didn't have that energy. But had I known that there was such an audience that needed me, that were watching me, that were looking up to me, I would have got that energy from them. That's the power of the audience, to give that energy, and it's a spiritual energy, it's not a psychological energy. And that explains the concept of Shimush Talmidei Chachomim. It's a lovely Gemara in Bava Kamma, where Rav Chisda says to Rami Bar Chama, ask Rami Bar Chama a question. And Rami Bar Chama gives a peculiar answer. He says, if you serve me, I'll give you the answer. Do something for me. So Rav Chisda folds up his talus for him. It's fine, now I'll tell you. And it's quite interesting to understand, what is that interaction? What in fact is going on? There are two ways of showing somebody that you need them. The one is to be a drain. The one is to nag, to be a nudnik. And the other way is to applaud them. The other way is to do something for them. That shows that you need them as well. It's a different kind of way of communication. What we're saying is that the performer's capacity to communicate to the audience depends on the extent to which the audience is able to display their need and trust in the performer. That's why it's very important when the performer walks on stage, they clap already. What are you clapping for? He hasn't done anything yet. What are you clapping? How do you know how he's going to perform? Oh, you did, because the better you clap in the beginning, the better a performance you'll get. There's no question about that. If he walks into the room and he feels loved and he feels accepted and he feels adoration from the crowds and they want him and they're going for him, he'll perform far better than if he walks into the silent room and nobody responds and everybody carries on talking and he's got to bang his violin on the stand a couple of times to get their attention, and then they're still carrying on and they're crackling their sweet papers while he's talking. They're going to get a completely different response. They're going to get a far superior response if before he even starts they show him that they need him, but not by nudniking him, not by nagging him. They show him that they need him by what they're able to give him, by the energy they give him. They energize him. They say, we need you to be at your best. What can we do to help you be at your best? How can we ease your burden? How can we cheer you up to make sure that you'll be at your best? That's what's really important. The members of the police force were explaining to me a little while ago how difficult it is for them, because the community doesn't appreciate them, and how they lose heart, how they don't want to help. They're human beings also. They're not being paid a lot of money. And when they get negative feedback from the community, sure, they slip up and they have problems also. Nobody tries to help. Everybody's complaining. That doesn't show that you need the person. The complaints box and lodging your complaints and on and on and on with your complaints, that drains the person.
It doesn't mean that doesn't make the person feel needed and valued. If you want the person to perform, you've got to show him that you trust him and you're able to do something for him. And that's the concept of Shimush Talmidei Chachomim. You have a great Talmid Chachom, you have a great Rosh Hashiva, a brilliant mind, Godel B'Yisrael, and I've got to go and learn with him. To facilitate his giving me of his best, I've got to show him that I entrust him with it, that I believe in him, that I'm dependent on him, that I need him. How do I do it? By nagging him? That will drain him. So I've got to find other ways of doing it. That's Shimush Talmidei Chachomim. Shimush Talmidei Chachomim is I do something for him that he can't do himself. Or that it's a waste of time for him to do himself. I would rather he wasn't doing it. If he has to get the groceries, let me go and get the groceries so that he can be thinking. Because I'll get the benefit of that. Let me take off his shoulders anything he doesn't have to be doing. So that he can be doing that which is unique to him. That which only he can do. What am I saying by that? I'm saying I believe that this only you can do. I can't do it. Nobody else can do it. We need you for that. So let's take everything else off you. So that all you have to do is that at which you're so good at. You go to the violinist and the same thing you say. Look here, Mr. Violinist. We want to hear music from you. Now all the other kind of rubbish that people have to do, forget about. We'll do that for you. We'll take care of that. That's the concept of a kollel. That's what a kollel is supposed to be. When you take an outstanding young man who's showing enormous promise in learning and possibilities of leadership and teaching potential and so on, and you say, we'll pay you to sit and learn. Stop with all the other nonsense. We need you for what you're really good at. It's not necessarily the way all kollels work today, but that was the original intention. The idea of paying somebody to sit and learn is not just a charity. Then you've got to give charity, so you might as well pay it to some yeshiva kollel. That wasn't the idea. The idea was we need that in you, so we'll take off all the other duties and responsibilities from you so that you can dedicate yourself to this one thing. That's what you need to do. And that's the idea of Shimush Talmidei Chachomim. That's how the Talmud gets close to the Rebbe. That's how the student gets close to the scholar, to the teacher. He establishes a relationship which is not a draining relationship, because the terrible thing about needing somebody is that you can create a drainage by needing somebody. Here you're creating and you're establishing a relationship and you're transmitting a message that says, I need you, but you're doing it in a way that doesn't drain him and make him feel totally responsible. Klal Yisrael did that to Moshe. What did they say? Moshe, we want meat! What did Moshe say? Ah, they need me. That really makes me feel good. I'm their cook as well. Fantastic. They need meat. I'll get them meat. I'm the butcher. Doesn't say that. He says, now they want meat. But he didn't used to say that. When they wanted water, it wasn't a problem for him. And when they wanted mon, it wasn't a problem for him. Why is it a problem now? Because he detects the misoinonim. He detects the gripes. He detects the complaints, the unhappiness, and turning to Moshe, not because they've entrusted Moshe and they love Moshe, but he detects a change in their attitude towards him. And that drains him so totally that he can't do it at all. He can't give of it at all. It's interesting. Sometimes people come up after shiurim. I'm not talking about anybody specifically, so don't get all self-conscious. And in one case I am. I'll tell you when I'm talking about somebody specific. But somebody once asked me why I try and get out of here as quickly as possible sometimes after shiurim. And I say, because it's enough already. You prepare a shiur, you give the shiur, and you want to get out, and it's draining to stay. And that got me thinking, why is it? Is it really draining? What is it draining? And then, you know, the Rebbeinu Shlomo has strange ways. He brings all sorts of messages to one. And then after a shiur, a person came up to me and he told me, he took what I had said and applied it to his area of expertise. He's a specialist in a certain area. And he gave me a whole application of that concept in his area of expertise. And recommended a couple of books which he thought I should read, and he'll bring me the books and he'll make sure that I get hold of them because he thinks it's important for me. And that brought me to question the whole issue of drainage and what exactly happened and why was that not draining? What normally happens after a shiur? So a couple of things. Again, I'm not talking about now. That was specific. Now I'm finished with specifics. I'm not talking about anybody now. What normally happens after a shiur? If somebody comes up to ask, what normally happens? There are a couple of things that are interesting. I'm taking you behind the scenes so you know what it's like on the side. One of the things that happens is sometimes people will ask a question on the shiur. It's not often a very good question. Why? Not because people aren't intelligent, but because people haven't had a time to integrate it. It's taken me weeks to prepare the shiur in a sense. The formal preparation is a few hours, but the informal preparation is weeks and sometimes more. And a lot gets packed into a shiur, and one needs time to think it through, to discuss it with somebody, to challenge it within one's own mind, to challenge it with other people, and then the questions start surfacing. So if people would come a week later and ask me on last week's shiur, That would be valuable. That would be interesting comments. But people don't generally do that. Very seldom you get a question on shiurim of weeks gone by. Usually it's on the shiur that you've just heard. On the shiur you've just heard, you don't understand it yet. You haven't integrated yet. It's not possible that you have. So what you're asking questions for already. First get the tape. Revise it. Make sure you heard it correctly. That you've questioned it yourself. That you've understood it. Let it boil a bit inside. And then there'll be creativity. Then when you ask a question, there'll be a contribution in the question. When you ask a question off the top, the chances are it's a draining question. The chances are you're asking me something that I already said, that you didn't hear. Or you're asking me something which had you just thought one little bit more, you would have worked out yourself. Or you're asking me something that if you'd thought a lot more, you would have worked out yourself. That's not exciting for the person who's teaching. That's draining for the person who's teaching. Another thing sometimes happens when a person comes after a shiur. He comes not to ask a question, he comes to give me a shiur. That happens very, very often. You can't believe how often it happens. In fact, my brother was once here. And it happens in all, it's not, I've checked it up, all Rosh Hashivas have it, and Magid Ashir, and Rabbonim, and lecturers, everybody has it. My brother was once telling, he said, but did you notice, everybody who came and they didn't ask you anything. They told you things they thought you didn't know. What do they think? You're an imbecile, so what do they come to your shiur for if they think you're such an imbecile? They'll tell you a medrash they saw, they'll tell you a vetelach they heard on the subject. I don't know, they'll tell you things they've heard. It happens occasionally, one out of every 20 or one out of 30, it's like, tell me something that I didn't know before. Very often I didn't know it before because it's not accurately quoted, or the source isn't accurate, or it doesn't mean quite what they think it works. Occasionally it's right, occasionally it's true. But that's draining stuff. If somebody's giving you a shiur, if a doctor gives you a lecture on some area in medicine, do you go up afterwards to tell him, yeah, you should care? And by the way, I don't know if you thought of this and if you thought of that, and I heard a lecture from another doctor and he said such and such. You keep quiet. It's his area of speciality. What are you going to start teaching him? But somehow when it comes to Torah, everybody's a specialist, and a guy is still using an art scroll and quoting from a linear translation, and he's kind of, that's draining stuff. That's not contributive stuff. What did this other person do? This other person said, I have an area of speciality. Now I am talking about somebody specific who's not here tonight. I have an area of speciality. There is an area that I know much better than Rabbi Lapp. That's my area of speciality. I can share that with him. I can give him something that he hasn't got. And thereby I'll show him how I appreciate it. How he's enriching my thinking, and I'll reciprocate by enriching his thinking. That's a wonderful thing. And that's what should happen in a shiur. You've got a shiur of different people from different disciplines, from different backgrounds, with different life experiences. Each person should take what he learns in the shiur, apply it in his own life area, and bring back a perspective which is unique to him. That's what's important. Not to bring back the same regurgitated stuff that one carries around, second-hand material that one has here and one has there, and a quote from here and a quote from there. That's not what thinking is all about. Thinking is taking what you've learned, integrating it into your own life experience, and then coming out with something that you've generated, that is your own idea, that other people don't have, and sharing it. That's what a thinking process is. And that's when there's a relationship between a teacher and a student that is not a draining one. That's a relationship which is an enriching one. And that's the meaning of Shimush Tamidei Chachomim. When one does for the teacher something he can't do for himself, or shouldn't be doing for himself. And what is the message you're saying? I value what you're teaching. I value what you're saying. I can do something for you too so that you can carry on enriching it and carrying on teaching. You're making that person feel valued and needed in a way which Moshe Rabbeinu would have welcomed. Had he had it, it would have given him the power to carry on. But he didn't have the power to carry on. Why? They want meat. And he detects they're not asking it of him because they recognize that he's the only one who can provide it. They're asking it of him to test him. They're asking of him because they no longer have the relationship with him that they used to have. No longer the relationship, as the Sipurnu says, of the father to his child, where the father knows that the child trusts the father, that the child knows that the father loves him, and the father will do his best for him. That we see also reflected in the well-known medrash that I've spoken about so many times in the beginning of the parasha. But there are actually two medrashim that somewhat conflict with one another. I won't go through them in detail, I'll just remind you of them. The one is to do with the lighting of the menorah. The one is where the Midrash says God doesn't need the light. And in fact, that's why the windows of the Beis HaMikdash are not designed the normal way, where the windows are wide on the outside and narrow on the inside, so that they gather a lot of light and focus it inside. But the windows in the Beis HaMikdash were the other way around. They were narrow on the inside and they were... wide on the inside and narrow on the outside to show that light was being taken from the Beis HaMikdash. That's not why he tells us to light the menorah, because he needs our light. The Lama Tzivo Eschem, so why does he tell you to do it? This Chuschem, for your own merit. Then the Midrash further on tells the story and says it's like the blind man leading the man who can see leading the blind man around. And finally he leads them all around and they do what they have to do and they come back to the home of the rich man, of the man who can see, and the man who can see says to the blind man, "Turn on the light, please." And he laughs, the blind man. He says, "All the time you've been leading me around, you can see, what do I know about light? Why are you asking me to turn on the light? What do you need me for?" And the man says, "To give you an opportunity to reciprocate. You couldn't see and I helped you. Now I can't see. It's dark. And you could help me. You could turn on the light in such a way that I can see. I'm giving you the chance to reciprocate." And so it is with Hashem. It's not that he needs the light, just as the man who could see could have turned the light on himself. But nevertheless, he gave the opportunity to the blind man to do it. So Hashem doesn't need our light, but he gives us the opportunity. What is the Midrash telling us? Hashem doesn't need our energy, that's true. Yet he gives us the opportunity to energize him. Does the violinist need our energy? He doesn't. He can play without us. He's played for years without us. But still, we can add something. When it comes to energy, a person can never have enough. And so it is with the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. There's something we can do to add to Hashem's energy. Why? Because he needs it? No, because we need it, says the Midrash. Because if we add to his energy, on the one hand there's the reciprocation issue, which we're not talking about tonight, we've talked about that before. But on the other hand there's the issue of, if I show him that trust, if I show him that contributiveness, if I'm able to energize him, I get the benefits of that. And that's the Shimush Talmidei Chachomim. We energize Hashem, we energize our Gedolim, we energize our Rosh Hashivas and our Magidei Shir, because by energizing them, we get the benefits. That's what we need to do. And so the way we energize is by showing them, as the Sifurna says, that complete trust in them, that understanding, that belief in them, and that trust in them. It's an upwards energizing. And that's what happens in the rugby field. It's not just a question of an emotional hype that occurs. There is the possibility, as we see with the spirits at the well, there is the possibility of people being able to create a spiritual power which gives an energy to another individual that enables him to perform in a most superlative way. It's a spiritual energy that he's able to convey. And that's something one has to learn. One has to watch these games and see it happen. You can see in front of your eyes. You can see it happen. It's not only in sports you see it. As I said, you see it in any performing area. You see the power, the spirituality that the audience is able to give the performer, to elicit from the performer superior performance. There's one final element to it. And that is, it doesn't always have to be bottom up. It can be top down too. And that's the Midrash that I quoted last night, where Moshe says, after this little piece that I just read to you, Moshe says, "I can't handle them on my own anymore." So Hashem says, "Appoint 70 elders." However, he says, of those 70 elders, and you need to know, you're going to have to give them their energy. And the Midrash brings an example at the end of this week's Seder. And says, for example, it's like a king who has an orchard and he hires a manager. And the manager says, after a while, "I can't manage this orchard on my own anymore. I want to hire a team underneath me who'll help me manage." And the king says, "Do what you want, that's fine. I've budgeted a certain amount of money for management. I've given that money over to you. If you manage it on your own, you keep it all for yourself. If you want to hire other people, then you share the income with other people. And that's your decision, that's your choice." In the same way, says Hashem, "I gave you the spirit and the knowledge to sustain my children. I didn't want anybody else other than you, Moshe. I wanted it to be a one-man show. So that you would have that all on your own. You would be unique in that. And you want somebody else. You should know, I'm not going to give them anything. I will take the spirit from you and give it to them. It's going to come from you." And I explained last night that in the case of the manager of the orchard, we're talking about reward, we're talking about salary. We're saying, are the wages for management I've given to you, now I'm going to give them to you, you have to give them to the others. Here we're not talking about rewards. Here Hashem is saying, I gave you the spiritual capacity to manage this. That's the reward of leadership. The reward of leadership is the expansion of capacity. And the expansion of capacity takes place right in the beginning. What I didn't deal with last night is, how does it work? How do you get that expanded capacity? You get that expanded capacity because people are entrusting you. Because people are supporting you. That's where you get it from. And when you've got the supportiveness of the people you're serving, you can do anything for them. Here Hashem says, however, when you take the 70 people, you're going to have to give them that trust. You're going to have to motivate them. You're going to have to drive them. You're going to have to give them. You're going to have to expand their capacity. That will be your role as leader. They don't have to get it from the people below. And that introduces a concept which I'm only going to touch on now. And in Mitzvah Hashem, I think I'm going to continue the shiur next week. Well, I'll announce it in the press as to what the title will be next week. But I think I'm going to continue the shiur. It's just too important. That opens up the new area of can you be energized if you don't have an audience? Can you be energized if the audience doesn't energize you? Moshe is crying and saying, I can't, it's enough already. Is it possible? What is Hashem saying to him? Is Hashem acknowledging, you're right Moshe, there's nothing you can do? Or is Hashem saying, look Moshe, you can't, I'll help you. But theoretically you could have, you failed by not being able to. And there we need to know that energy can come from the top as well. If you believe that the Ribbono Shel Olam has entrusted you to a certain job, whatever that job is, whether it's raising your children, or running your business, or giving a shiur, or teaching somebody, or whatever it is, if you believe that Hashem has entrusted you with that, He's chosen you to do that, and He's given you the job, and He believes you can, all the energy you need can come from the top, it doesn't have to come from the bottom. And Hashem says to Moshe, I'm not going to energize your 70 people, because then they're going to have direct communication with me, and they're going to undermine your leadership. The only way this can function is if you energize them. You're going to have to show your faith and your trust in them. You're going to have to give them the energy they need in order to perform with the kind of superlative quality that we're talking about. That's going to be your function. But the Medrash adds a very important point and says, "Ve'afal pi kein," but you should know, nevertheless, Moshe lo chiser klum. Moshe lost nothing in the process. When the manager of the orchard has to share his income with the other managers, he loses some of his own income. But when it's a matter of energizing, you don't lose anything by energizing others. On the contrary, you gain too. And that's why back to the Medrash at the beginning of Baal Oischa, when Hashem says, I don't need your energy, I'm doing it lizchuschem, I'm doing it for you. So that by lighting the menorah, by energizing me, that's what the menorah symbolizes, man energizing God. And what results from that? A more energetic God? No, that's not the issue. A more energetic man. Because when a human being energizes people, he doesn't lose anything, on the contrary, he gains. His own energy is strengthened, his own energy becomes more vital too. And that's what we need to understand. And so yes, one looks at these audiences, one looks at these people playing, and one says, is there a transference of energy from the audience to the players? And the answer is that yes, there is. And it's not illusionary, and it's not emotional, and it's not psychological, it's spiritual. It is the ability of a human being to perform inordinately well. If he feels that he is needed and trusted by a whole lot of people out there that show their need and trust energetically. Remember, bring your sticks and stones and make a noise and shout, ours is winning, ours is winning. There needs to be a visible manifestation of that need. It's not something that can be done delicately by sending a letter before and saying, you know, I think that you're a great guy and I think that, I need you and I support you. It's getting out there with a noise and showing the person the degree of support that he needs to hear in order to get out of him that kind of performance. But when there isn't the audience to do that, one can do it oneself. If one is a Baal Amonah, if one is able to entrust the Ribbono Shel Olam in the same way that the cat in the pit was trusted, if one can trust the Ribbono Shel Olam with that same degree of trust, and one understands that he trusts us, and we have that kind of relationship with him, then self-motivation becomes realistic. Then one can find within oneself the strengths resulting from the trust that God has placed in us to perform the duties and the jobs which He has put before us, and the understanding that He has given us the capacity, He knows we can do it, and He trusts us to perform.